I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for being here today. We've got Chase Purdy here, the author of Billion Dollar Burger, and I can't wait to start talking about the book. He's a reporter, and he's written for Quartz, Politico, and he's been in newsrooms across the American South, including the Roanoke Times, the Ledger, the News Virginian. He's a national fellow at New America and lives in New York City, where we are both sweltering in this very hot heat. That's redundant, isn't it? Hot heat. Anyway, welcome to It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me. And let's take a big bite out of this billion dollar burger.
Yeah, sounds good. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I've been talking about food on this program for 11 years. And I want to let you know I'm a vegan for 32 years, so I come from a plant background. The plant burgers are a big interest, naturally, to those who want to see the end of factory farming, want to see the end to the immense cruelty that's in our food system. Sure. So tell me, how did you get into cultured cell meat?
Right. Well, you know, it was about 7 or so years, a little more than 7 years ago now, I started working at Politico. And my, you know, one of my beat responsibilities was to cover sort of the influence of the meat industry. And whenever you start covering meat companies, it's not long after that that you start hearing from animal welfare activists. And I got to know some of them pretty well. And through the years that are talking with them and learning about cell-cultured meat, I sort of put two and two together and realized that some of the a lot of the entrepreneurs and a lot of the funders who are behind cultured meat are in fact people who sort of sprang from the vegan movement. And so, you know, that's kind of how cultured meat kind of got on my radar. I moved over to Quartz after Politico, and it was once I was at Quartz that I started really covering more the technology of food. And so I was able to dig into cultured meat in a whole other way, basically. And one thing led to another, and sort of roped myself into to working on a book about the subject. And it's been great.
Well, it's definitely an interesting story. It's fun to read. It's easy to read. So you're a good writer.
Yes. That's good to hear.
There are some drier books on the subject, so that's a good thing. The question, of course, is, do we believe in cultured cell meat? And of course, there are many ways to say it, right? Clean meat.
Yeah, cultured meat is maybe the easiest one.
Okay, cultured meat, laboratory meat, Frankenstein, whatever. I'm sure there are lots of all kinds of names for it.
The weirdest one I've heard is motherless meat.
Motherless meat.
Doesn't that sound appetizing?
Well, we don't want to go there because there are lots of things that people call food that I don't think are appetizing.
True.
And probably vice versa. Vice?
Yeah,
vice
definitely.
Vice versa. I mean, I remember I don't even think I was vegan. I was vegetarian and I was in college and I thought, okay, it's time to try tofu. And I was just so afraid of it. It was ridiculous. It's a bean. Anyway, I got through it though. And I've eaten a lot more tofu ever since, happily. But back to cultured meat. So you talk about a number of different scientists and entrepreneurs in the book. You focus, I think, mostly on Josh Tetrick. Did he get most of the pages in the book?
Yeah.
Seemed Josh like it to me.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So let's talk about him. I remember back in 2013, 7 years ago, I interviewed him on this program. He was 33 years old. And at the time he was just working on his egg product, which at the time he called Beyond Eggs. And for those who have followed Josh Tetrick, like I have, we've seen how nimble he can be just with the name of his company and the names of his products, which have changed. And so the Beyond Egg became Just Egg and Just and
yeah,
a variety of things.
Yeah, the company's name was in fact Hampton Creek, and then they sort of changed that relatively recently to just very simply Just. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Hampton, he had said, was named after his best friend's dog.
Yep.
And then Creek, it just sounded like an old food company, like Battle Creek Food, Battle yeah. Creek, Michigan or something. Yeah. Anyway, I was very excited about what he was doing at the time. Primarily, not just because it would save animals. Well, yes, that's the primary reason. It would save animals. But it made sense to me because the egg product that he was going to make was going to go into industrial foods primarily.
Right.
And industrial foods are disgusting. I mean, they're made of the worst ingredients. They're not healthy for you. And the people who consume them don't seem to care. Or they may be in a situation where those are the only foods around them and they're affordable, whatever. It was an improvement on a system that was already in place that I thought was great. And of course, ultimately, I would hope that everybody at some point in the future would want to eat a healthy diet made of simple foods that nature provided for us that didn't include animals, but okay. And now things have changed quite a bit because he's got products on the shelf. He's got things. He's got a whole food system, a business right. in place. And now he's looking at the cultured meat. And you've talked about his whole arc.
Yeah.
In the book, which was fascinating. One thing I wanted to mention was he seemed to welcome you into his plan. And discussions about food. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, he, you know, I told him about the project when I approached him and, you know, he has felt pretty optimistic about sort of his company's placement in this sort of nascent industry and the ability to basically get a sort of simple cultured meat product out in the market relatively soon. And I think in Josh's mind, you know, the way that the impression that I had was that this was a really important technology. It was an important moment to document. And he was, and he sort of, I think, sees himself as like a vehicle for this to get across the finish line. And for that reason, I think he was very open to this being covered. He was open to me coming in and asking any questions I wanted to ask. And you know, gave a lot of access. I went to San Francisco a whole bunch of times over the course of my reporting, and I would spend, you know, large chunks of that time just sort of sitting in Just's headquarters, talking with scientists, checking out the labs, eating some of the cultured meat product that they were making, having long conversations with him. I mean, he was very much an open book through this process.
That's wonderful. I like to compare that to the meat industry, which more and more has become closed and opaque, not wanting people to know what's going on inside. And in your work, have you been able to go into slaughterhouses and industries that are making
meat? Yeah. I think that, you know, when you cover the meat industry, you know, they usually do press tours through, you know, certain facilities. You know, would it be easy for me to line up like walking through a random plant in a random state? You know, that would probably be tougher, but you know, they definitely, you know, do show you some of the nitty gritty. But you know, in terms of, I think what maybe one of the things you're getting at, you know, in terms of getting ag gag laws passed around the country, I think being really protective about, you know, what you can see going on in their properties, even down to the fact that, you know, they're not releasing a lot of data around COVID-19 infections going on in meatpacking plants. I think that, yeah, the idea that the meat industry is a relatively opaque one is true. And I think, too, that you can't just give, cell cultured meat companies a passing grade on this either. I mean, there's a lot that we don't know. I mean, I had the benefit and the privilege of being able to go through laboratories, but like, I don't have a degree. I don't know a degree in science, this high tech science. So I don't necessarily know what's in every single liquid medium that cells feed on that they need to proliferate. I don't know the the intricacies of the bioreactors that are being used, these big sort of beer vats where cells grow into muscle tissue or fat tissue. I don't know like the life cycle analyses of cultured meat. I don't know because they haven't been released yet. And I don't know the exact data points of like a nutritional analysis of this meat. There's a lot. I think that cultured meat is something that is, and you know, to Josh's credit, like so far they've been pretty open about sharing what they can. But there's so much more that we should be thoughtful about and asking these companies. I think as with any company that wants to feed you food, you know, something that you stick in your mouth, you should have all sorts of questions and we should demand transparency. And I think that as these companies get closer and closer to market, I think that, you know, hopefully we'll see people demanding that transparency and asking really smart questions and figuring out exactly what our relationship is with these new food companies who want to feed us this sort of very fascinating meat product that like hasn't really been something we've ever consumed yet.
Well, you brought up some really good points and I want to expand on them a little bit.
Sure.
So the food industry has had an interesting history and I've read a lot of books on them and articles and some of it's good and some of it's not so good. And part of it is the science and the chemistry involved in making industrial foods. And there have been ingredients that have been put into foods to increase their shelf life, a variety of things to make them less expensive that ultimately are not good for the human body. And there are many small nonprofit groups and parent organizations and maybe even some bigger organizations that are now trying to get more transparency and get questionable ingredients out of these foods. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it has impacted many people's health as a result, children's lives. We have a whole autoimmune disease epidemic. And of course, there isn't solid proof about the cause of many of these diseases. There's strong correlation that it's related right. to industrial foods.
Yeah.
So this is really concerning. And so when we talk about the cultured meat, it's another type of food, another high-tech food that may come with some benefits, but who knows what they'll also come with.
Right. So yeah, you can think about cultured meat in a lot of different ways. And, you know, one of those ways that you can think about it is sort of the granddaddy of processed food, right? I mean, you are taking something that would normally come from a living organism and you're saying, you know what, we can do this in the settings that we dictate. And sure, it'll be the same on a molecular level. Sure, it'll be the same on a nutritional level, but we're gonna do it ourselves. That sort of is a highly processed food in its own right. I don't think that it can be conflated with like a Pop-Tart, for instance, but I, you know, this is, I think anytime humans sort of say like, you know what, we're gonna do the job of nature. Maybe we'll even do it better. That does sort of lend itself for pause and it lends itself for questions and it sort of demands thoughtfulness on our parts as consumers.
So two things I want to talk about continuing on this subject before we move on to something else is meat. And you had talked a lot about Mark Post in your book and we can mm-hmm. talk about him in a moment, but and at one point you asked him about cloning and he agreed that this is a form of cloning, making cultured meat. And so cloning in a way is minimizing diversity. And we have lots of plant foods, for example, that are monocropped, soy and alfalfa and corn. And this is also affecting human health and the health of the planet because we're learning over and over with so many different areas that diversity is better. And when we simplify, that can be problematic as well. And then the other thing is, I don't think meat is a healthy food. So mimicking it or making it like it is, I personally don't see the benefits of that. So cloning.
Right, well, I think that there's a fair amount. I think there are a couple different things here. I think that, you know, it's difficult to say that meat isn't necessarily a healthy food. I think, you know, in my experience and going through sort of research You know, you can look even to like the Eat Lancet report, which came, you know, was sort of in partnership with Harvard. There are a lot of countries in this planet, including the United States, where sort of the recommendation is to be eating less meat, because we have no, we are not in any way threatened with protein scarcity in the US, not at all. In fact, we eat about double the amount of protein that we need. And so there are recommendations to be eating less meat. There are countries in the world though where protein deficiency is a real thing and meat happens to be a terrific vehicle for carrying a lot of the nutrients and the proteins and sort of the things that our bodies need really well. And so in those cases, there are in fact recommendations to be eating more meat. There's definitely sort of like a minority of countries, but that is the case in those places. And I think, you know, another thing to think about here is like when you do talk about whether meat is healthy or unhealthy, not all meat is equal. You can take sort of a chicken breast, which I know is not something that you're interested in eating, but there's a difference between a chicken breast and a chicken tender. There's a difference between like a chicken breast and a hot dog, or, you know, highly processed foods, highly processed meats, like burgers and hot dogs and tenders and nuggets are packed with sodium in lots of cases. And we definitely are eating too much sodium in the United States. So I don't want to like necessarily, I don't think it would be fair to necessarily conflate the quality of those foods together, first of all. So, you know, in terms of like the overall nutritional quality of meat, I don't think I'm comfortable, you know, and I'm also not a nutrition, I'm not a dietitian, and I'm not, you know, sort of a nutrition expert, not in a position to say that, you know, meat is bad for people. I think certain kinds of meat have been shown to carry lots of things like sodiums that are detrimental to our health, especially in the US where we're facing, you know, obesity being a gateway towards increased risk of stroke and like cardiovascular disease and diabetes, type 2 diabetes, things like that. This is something to consider, but most of that's been linked back to, I believe, to processed meats. And in terms of cloning, you know, yeah, I did ask Mark Post. I said, you know, what's a question that you never get from people? And he said, a question that I never get, and I'm glad I never get it, is cultured meat cloned meat? And I was sort of like, okay, is it? And he said it was. He said it's basically sort of the non-sexual reproduction of something, and therefore it's cloning. He also said if you go and talk to any of the other scientists in the cell cultured meat space, that they would all disagree. And we sort of had a little bet on the table as well. I think it was like a bottle of bourbon or something. And So I went out, and over the course of the next year during reporting, I'd always kind of like sprinkle that question in. And it's true, like they all sort of said, no, it's not. And the reality is that cloning is a really complicated term. There's actually not a great definition for cloning, which is hard to believe. You know, there are different kinds. You can have organismic cloning, cellular cloning, molecular cloning. It's often thought of as producing an individual organism with like an identical or sort of intentionally modified DNA structure to another individual. And like you can do that with bacteria and yeast. You could do it with the sheep. But, you know, it's not really necessarily fair, I don't think, to call cultured meat cloned meat, because by growing and dividing cells that are inherently copying their own DNA into other cells, you could call it cellular cloning, but scientists actually generally use the term culturing. That is just the term that we typically use for this kind of scientific work. And so, that is why there's sort of a little split in this. Like Mark Post would say, it's cloning. Technically, sure it is, but it's also culturing. So it's a muddy little debate. But in terms of like cloning, it's fun to talk about, but also I think we're kind of at this sort of point where, you know, maybe we need a better definition for what cloning is and isn't versus how that's different from culturing cells for meat.
It will likely be left up to the marketing departments to figure out what they want to call their products.
That will, yes, they're still figuring that out.
Because they're the ones who determine what people respond positively or negative to. And yeah, it's all about selling the product and not really being transparent.
In some cases, yeah, for sure. I mean, they are playing around, like there are terms like cultivated meat. I mean, it's really tough, like, right? You don't necessarily want to, I guess the goal on their end is to be straightforward if they can be. but also to not freak people out, because you wouldn't want to buy something probably called cloned meat. You probably maybe wouldn't want to buy something called cell cultured meat or in vitro meat or lab grown meat. But would you eat something called clean meat that's supposed to evoke like clean energy, because it does sort of have like a, you know, the potential for a much lesser environmental footprint than animal agriculture? Maybe. Would you be interested in seeing something called cell-based meat? Josh Tetrick would say, why not just call it meat if that's what it is on a nutritional and a microscopic level? Then why would meat not just work? And that, of course, leads into a whole debate around lobbying and et cetera, et cetera. But it's interesting. And what they call this will be sort of a fascinating debate to watch sort of unfurl.
Exactly. Well, unfortunately, the thread through all of this is capitalism. And there are plant-based milks, plant-based meats, plant-based eggs, plant-based butters, plant-based cheeses. They're all out on the market and they're starting to grab market share. And this is getting scary to the people who are making, I'm using air quotes here in audio land, traditional meats and eggs and milk and cheese and butter made from animals. Mm-hmm. And we're leaving it to the courts to decide ultimately, because there are a mess of lawsuits out now regarding different cheese products and milk products made from plants and whether we can call them milk. It's ridiculous, because decades ago, for a long time, we've had lots of things that have been called milk. We have coconut milk, we have milk of magnesia. Nobody seemed to care. But now that it's starting to take a bite out of the cow milk industry, there's concern because of the bottom line. And the same thing is true with the meat industry, because now they're starting to see the impact on their bottom line with that these plant products are taking, and ultimately maybe the cultured meat is even scarier to them from a financial standpoint.
Right. I think it's, you know, this is an interesting area. I think that, you know, this is definitely more, I think that you definitely see that kind of reaction, especially from like the people who work in the dairy world right now. Meat is a little bit more nuanced, I think, because you are seeing signs that, you know, some segments of the meat industry, like the ranchers, for instance, are definitely feeling like threatened by, you know, the idea what they would call fake meat, which includes the plant-based and the cell culture varieties. But you're also seeing companies as large as like Tyson and Smithfield and JBS. You're seeing companies like those who are actually sort of interested in cultured meat and interested in plant-based meat. Tom Hayes, the former CEO of Tyson back in March 2017, appeared on Fox Business when he was the CEO of that company. And he sort of stopped short of calling Tyson a meat company. He called it a protein company. And he basically explained that that's because, you know, people are interested in conventional animal protein. People are interested in plant-based protein. Maybe someday they'll be interested in cell-cultured protein. Either way, like, Tyson has potentially a role to play in all of that. And so by positioning that company as a protein company and no longer as like a meat company, they're sort of opening the doors for their own evolution. So it's not all aggressive. And they're also sprinkling money onto, you know, I think Tyson invested a bit of money a while back into Beyond Meat, a plant-based meat company. Tyson has also worked with Future Meat Technologies over in Israel. I believe they've also worked a little bit with Memphis Meat, a cell-cultured meat company based in Silicon Valley. So the meat system isn't in like sort of this to, you know, meat alternative products. They are interested. I think that if anything, maybe they're looking over at how the dairy industry has responded to plant-based milks, for instance, and has seen that the strategy of really fighting tooth and nail against them from using this terminology, fighting tooth and nail against consumer interest, isn't really working. And so if you can't beat them, maybe join them.
Well, I remember Unilever did that. You talked a little bit about it in your book with Just Tetrick when they put a lawsuit against him for his Just Mayo, and saying he couldn't call it mayonnaise. And he said he wasn't calling it mayonnaise, he was calling it mayo.
Right, yeah.
And in the end, he got a ton of free marketing and lots of investment funding after that event. And Unilever, a year later, came out with a vegan mayonnaise. If you can't beat him, join him.
Right, yeah, yeah. So that classic David and Goliath story, too.
But Josh Tetrick has invited meat companies to work with him. You talk in your book about he's encouraging licensing ingredients and he wants them to invest.
Yeah, and Josh is sort of in his dream world, you know, JBS down in Brazil would build out a 30,000 square foot facility and start using sort of like his company's recipes and sort of technology and build out their own facility and start making meat and sort of like, you know, would start growing meat from cells in a massive scale. That's what he wants.
We were talking about Mark Post before. Can you just tell people who he is for those who don't remember some of the big events he was involved with?
Yeah, it might actually be good to even just sort of explain, you know, I know it's a little bit late in this now, but explain what cell-cultured meat is, and then maybe that leads to Mark Post. But his story is really interesting. So basically, you know, the idea of cell-cultured meat actually isn't really all that new. It really came about from this Dutch scientist, not Mark Post, but a man named Willem van Eelen, who a very long time ago grew up in sort of Indonesia when it was a Dutch colony. And during World War II, he was sort of swept up by the Japanese and he was in a prisoner of war camp. And in this prisoner of war camp, he watched people starve in front of him. And that impacted him in a huge way. He did survive the war and he ended up going to the Netherlands where he enrolled in medical school. And while in medical school, he saw cells being cultured. At that time, cells were being cultured for things, but it was all for like medical use. Things like if you have a serious burn, like maybe we could culture cells to help with skin regeneration, things like that. And while lots of people in the medical field were looking at this technology and thinking like, wow, this is incredible for these maladies that people face, Willem van Eelen thought, well, could we eat it? And his whole goal was like, why should anyone go hungry? Why, if food security is a thing, we should be growing meat this way maybe. And so he made it his life's work to like make this happen. And that included pulling together a consortium of scientists. And it took many years and he really scraped together all the funding that he could to make this work. And in this consortium of early scientists was Dr. Mark Post. And Mark Post in 2013 was able to, he reached this point where he had painstakingly done the cell culturing work with a few of other people in his laboratory at Maastricht University. Or University of Maastricht in the Netherlands. And they made the first cell-cultured beef burger patty. And they presented that on a stage in London. And that was before all sorts of international media. It was covered by the New York Times and NPR and the Times of London, and you name it. It was like being written about. It was this sort of fascinating flashpoint in the history of cultured meat. And you know, basically what he did and what cell cultured meat is what you do is you do like a harmless biopsy on an animal and you collect sort of a handful of cells, hopefully stem cells. And you basically take that stem cell and you feed it essentially a nutrient dense liquid medium, which is like a mouthful to say. The simple way of putting it is if you think about an animal body, chicken, cow, what have you, they have blood coursing through them. Blood carries all sorts of nutrients. Those nutrients are eaten by cells which replicate over and over and over again. And basically, these companies have basically created their own sort of like nutrient dense liquid mediums. And so the cells feed on these and they feed on them in these sort of temperature, pH, oxygen controlled environments. So in an animal, this happens in like a cow's body. In cell cultured meat, this happens in what is ostensibly a beer vat. It's called a bioreactor. And in these bioreactors, you grow these cells into fat tissue and into muscle tissue, and you put the two things together and you have what is real meat. Muscle provides a lot of the texture, fat provides a lot of the taste, and these are the early products that we have now. And Mark Post is still doing this, by the way. His company is Mosa Meat. It's at the forefront of this, what I would call like an edible space race to get cultured meat to market. He's based in the Netherlands still. And they just announced actually that they are building out their very first pilot production facility. He's one of five companies in the world out of the 30-ish that are actually building out the first production facilities. So this is sort of an exciting moment in cultured meat. And he's was there at the beginning and he's still in it.
And unlike Josh Tetrick and other entrepreneurs who are in this cultured meat business with an idea to eliminate the cruelty that's involved in the food system, Mark Post is not a vegan. But as you mentioned, he is interested in food sustainability.
Yeah, that's correct. Mark Post is a meat eater, in fact, and he is in this for, yeah, food security and environmental reasons.
There are lots of reasons to do this. The thing that just, this is just me, okay?
Yeah.
And I don't have any power at all in this food industry. I just have my little opinion. And my opinion is frustrating because from my point of view, I'm being redundant here. My opinion from my point of view is we already have the answers. We have the answers to feed everyone in abundance on this planet now and in the future. And it's with organically grown plant foods, kind of grown in a different way than grown today. Not bigger is more efficient, but smaller is better and more accessible and safer for the planet. And there's lots of science behind this and lots of articles on it, and it's all here. But what isn't here is the demand. And the demand, in my opinion, isn't here because the money isn't behind it, because it isn't something that has much value added to it to make a small amount of people a lot of money. And in this cultured meat arena, this is exciting to angel investors. This is exciting to capitalists because here is a product that you can grow, you can make it in large quantities, and you can make big profits from it. It's not necessarily the best situation, the best product to lead us to the best result. But the people who are in power are the people that have the funding to support the products that will make them more money.
Right. I think that you could definitely like make that. I mean, when I think about this, my brain sort of naturally drifts off into Alice Waters' world and sort of the slow food movement and the power of the local agricultural economy. And, you know, even if you don't want to, even if you are not a vegan or a vegetarian, like there are ways to sort of have like this local ag economy that includes like livestock. And, you know, the reality is that the slow food movement has been around for a long time and it really just hasn't made much of a footprint. You're right. Like there are, and then to an extent, this is sort of a way of life of the privileged. The way that we're set up in the U.S., I mean, this isn't, we don't really live in a society at this point, and whether, you know, I think this is just very a systemic sort of issue, but the sort of dreamland of the slow food movement and organic foods and like these like super nutrient dense plant food diets that could satisfy our every sort of nutritional need, although every person's nutritional needs a little bit different. It's lofty on its own, and it's lofty when you think about how even just try thinking about that just through the lens of food access.
I totally get that. Just reading a story
the other day in the New Yorker about how dollar stores basically are now the grocery stores in so many communities. And, you know, I mean, that's a systemic issue. And it's not a good one.
No, distribution is a big problem, and that's all over the world. And yet we have investment money going into making genetically modified foods, which we don't need. And those same funds could go into improving organic farming all around the world, creating opportunities and access and distribution channels so that everyone is fed. But that's not where the focus is, because that's not where the profit is. Okay. So what and do I'm we not, get? Yeah, and to so be rather sure, than I, black bean burgers, and you know, people can be convinced to eat and enjoy anything, anything with the right amount of marketing. And that's a scary thing, but it's true because people are eating a lot of crap and they've been convinced that that's what they want to eat. Thanks to marketing. And people could be convinced otherwise with benefits, health and the health of the planet. But that's me. And there's only a few of us around that are talking this way. But, oh, I wanted to just make a couple of other points before I let you go. You made some commentaries about the strategy of a vegan abolitionist versus the strategy that Josh Tetrick is making. And there are lots of choices that can be made in order, a means to an end. So the idea is that we eliminate animals from the food system or at least reduce them significantly. And you also talked a lot about Bruce Friedrich in your book, who I've known for over decades. And I remember him as an activist with PETA and then with Farm Sanctuary and now with the Good Food Institute. And his approach has changed dramatically over the decades. And it's continuing on this theme that if we really want to make change, we have to make it within the current system that we have, which is this capitalistic system. So you had a story about Ira, is that how her name was pronounced? Ira?
Ira Van Eelen, yeah. She was the daughter of the guy who first created the idea of this, yeah.
Right, and so she was talking about getting arrested and taking an abolitionist approach, an all or nothing approach with the cultured meat that she wasn't even allowed to grow in her own country, which she wanted to try and grow in her own house. I'm just philosophically talking about the abolitionists in any society or the ones who feel like what we're doing is wrong and we need to do this way versus those who take a middle of the road approach to slowly make incremental steps in a certain direction.
It's a fascinating area. It's also one that like I can only speak to based on like my own reporting. I'm not a vegan. I am not a massive meat eater. And I don't sort of engage in sort of animal rights activism at any level. So, you know, from my point of view comes from just like the reporting I've done. But yeah, I mean, like you pretty much nailed it. Like there are basically two strains. I mean, for a long time, I think Josh Tetrick, Bruce Friedrich, Josh Balk, who is mentioned in this book, there are several people in this book. I mean, the original, actually the fun thing about this book is that the original sort of idea of it did morph. It was originally going to be about how, you know, seven or so vegan friends at the time in the early 2000s in Washington, D.C., all kind of decided together to deviate from that abolitionist approach. The way that I've kind of phrased it before, which I imagine you probably won't totally agree with, is that the vegan movement's brain finally outgrew its heart and they decided to use that sort of momentum to create change in another way. And, you know, you can talk to people like Gary Francione, by the way, who will just like, absolutely, he despises the moves that Josh Tetrick and Bruce Friedrich and such have made. He's very much one of those abolitionists. And
I think I know him well. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think it's very much kind of what is your goal? I mean, for a long time, I think that a lot of sort of vegans in this movement, you know, I forget exactly, one of the people in this movement, it was, I think, Paul Shapiro, basically said, if we're screaming and shouting so loudly, why is nobody listening? And I think that after a while, that kind of led to reconsidering an approach. And yes, this approach means subverting the capitalist system from inside it, which ultimately just means joining the capitalist system and working from within it. And these are definitely people who are, they're making moves. And are they finding success? I mean, you can look at the rise of Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods, the plant-based companies already, and see the tremendous amount of interest in them. just the other day, Impossible Foods announced it's going to be available in Trader Joe's all over the country. So like, are they making a dent? It's small now, but they've also only been around for a couple of years. What will this look like in 10 years? What will happen if you have a cultured meat product, for instance, that matches the taste exactly, matches the texture exactly, but actually costs less money? What happens in those cases? What happens if you're going to offer Kobe beef or bluefin tuna, very expensive items, to people for the first time? Cost. That could drastically, you know, restructure how the meat system operates to save. I mean, right now we kill 65 billion land animals a year. That doesn't include, obviously, the 1 to 2 trillion fish a year to feed ourselves animal flesh. What happens if you cut that in half? And could that be done in a matter of like a couple of decades? How would you measure that success, even if it did come through the instruments of capitalism? These are like big questions. And are they taking a purist tact at this? Absolutely not. But I think also hard to argue that they're not really accomplishing change in the hearts of people who aren't vegan and who never would have maybe thought about eating a plant-based burger before.
A lot of people compare this movement with other movements like civil rights movements. And I'm thinking about slavery in this country, for example, and now we're having an explosion with all the protests that are going on with Black Lives Matter and the George Floyd unfortunate event. And what has happened in this country has been small steps to make change. And we didn't take the big leap. Sure, we got rid of slavery, but at the time when that happened, we didn't give the people what they needed to survive when they went from slavery to free men and they had no homes and nothing and no careers. And anyway, so I like to look at those other events that have happened and see how small incremental change has brought us to where we are versus big leaps. We never take big leaps. We take small incremental change. And of course, we'll see what happens. But we still have problems with those other civil rights issues where we're making incremental change. It's hard. It's hard to change people. It's hard to change the people who have the power and the means to impact the life for all of us.
Yeah, but, and I imagine that if you made a massive sweeping change to something, that would come with all sorts of hiccups and issues on its own. I don't know if there's any, you know, from an outsider point of view who looks at this, and I find it very interesting, sort of that abolitionist versus non-abolitionist approach, or abolitionist and capitalist approach, if you want to put it that way. Both are fascinating. Is there any one way to accomplish the same goal? I don't know. My thought is probably not. There are probably multiple ways to achieve something. I imagine if you talk to a lot of sort of day-to-day people who care about animal welfare, I bet that they, you know, I can't speak for anybody, but it strikes me that, you know, being an absolutist about this probably ultimately in the long run achieves less if your goal is to end animal suffering.
Okay, before we go, can you tell us about pluripotent, what it is?
So yeah, you know, when you write a book about cell cultured meat and cellular agriculture, you get a little bit nerdy about the subject. And, you know, whenever you're a journalist, you can pitch all sorts of stories. But after a while, your editors get a little bit tired of hearing cell cultured meat stories coming their way. So I decided to start a newsletter on Substack, where every week I sort of just dive into an element of cell cultured meat and like cellular agriculture world. I'm talking, you know, right now with actually a rabbi doing a deep dive into sort of like, would this be kosher? Would this be, you know, okay to eat if you're like an adherent Jew when it comes to kashrut rules? I think that, you know, I recently put out one on the cloning issue. So Pluripotent is just my weekly newsletter for people who are interested in being nerdy about cultured meat.
Yeah, I love it. Well, I wanted my listeners to know about it because I think some of them would actually be interested in subscribing to Pluripotent. Sounds like an interesting venture.
Definitely.
Chase Purdy, thanks for joining me and thanks for writing Billion Dollar Burger. I want to say that it's an interesting read, and for those who are interested in food history, this is an important one.
Thank you so much.
How the industry works and works today in the current world. This is an important book. Billion Dollar Burger, Inside Big Tech's Race for the Future of Food. Thank you, Chase.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Stay cool. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, now I've got Gary DiMattei here with me. Hi, Gary.
Hey, Karen. That was a great interview with Mr. Purdy.
Yeah, so I thought we'd have a little talk back now.
Oh, great.
After
That's terrific.
I spoke with the author.
I like that.
Yeah.
You know, the thing I find very interesting is that as a world, not just a nation, but as a world, well, half the world, I guess, we're obsessed with burgers. I mean, even vegan burgers, veggie burgers. You go on the top veggie sites, the most commercial veggie sites out there. I've gone to three of them, the veggie news sites. Not veg news. Although veg news is one of them.
That give news about...
Sites that give news about what's going on in the vegan veggie world. And each of these sites, in addition to veg news, has a prominent picture of a burger on their website. One of the sites has... Trader Joe's now has the vegan Impossible Burger in bulk. And then you go to another site and it's got, you know, the top 20 veggie burgers out there. And then you go to another site and it's got, you know, another big picture of a veggie burger all loaded up with toppings and things like that. And now there's all of this, as you were discussing with Mr. Purdy, there's all of this money being invested in cloning these beef cells and making burger out of it. And I just want to know why.
Okay, that's a great question. And I'm going to flip it right back at you because I used to call you my burger boy. I call you my burrito boy and my pancake boy, but burger boy.
I know. You're interviewing now for the last 5 or 6 minutes of your program, the burger boy.
The burger boy.
I'm asking you in a way too loud voice that you're probably going to have to fix in post-production. Why are we so obsessed with burgers?
Yeah, so I mean, why are we, Gary? You're the one who loved burgers. Even when we would go out back in the days when we went to restaurants, boo-hoo, boo-hoo, because we haven't been to one in so long. Maybe more years ago and maybe not as much in the last couple of years, you always would go for
the burger. I just want to ask, what in the world is wrong with us? Why do we need to now invest all of this money into cloning cells so that people will feel okay about eating burgers, which are made from beef that now isn't sustainable? And why can't they just flip it and go to a veg burger? I did. And like you said, I'm the burger boy.
You're the burger boy.
I mean, I ate so many burgers. I was known as Wimpy. I mean.
That's funny. Now, you know, this laboratory meat, this cultured meat we're talking about, they're not just making it for burgers. They've got.
Yeah, I know.
Some guys are trying to make.
Chicken nuggets.
Chicken nuggets. And, some are making bacon. They're making all kinds of duck pate.
Is it because people just don't feel good about not eating flesh? They don't want to eat vegetables. They want to eat flesh. I mean, are we really that? Have we really gone there
so much money going into this. So much money because we don't believe that the world would know how to feed itself on primarily plants.
I think the world wouldn't know how to feed itself if it didn't have this drive-through restaurant that everyone can go to now and buy burgers and fries. It's ridiculous. I think it's ridiculous. I love what Chase did with his book, how he's pointing this out for all of us to interpret as we will. And I think it's a great book.
Well, there's no going back. The science.
Oh. But there's no going back for me, Karen. I don't want to go back. I don't want to go back to a flesh burger. You know, the veil has been lifted, as I've said a million times on this program. There is no going back to flesh. I don't care if it's made in a laboratory. I don't care if, you know, it's all of a sudden they come up with how to do this so nothing suffers. I can't believe that something isn't going to suffer because of this. I can't go back. There's no going back.
Well, what's going to suffer, it's who's going to suffer.
they say, they talk about making a product that's going to be like meat, but maybe healthier than meat.
Yeah, but maybe healthier. I don't believe that. And you know what? I don't think this can be healthy.
I don't think so either. It's funny, too, because it's like when genetically modified foods were coming out and they were saying on one hand that they were talking out of two sides of their mouth, saying it's exactly the same product, which is why it should be approved for human consumption. But at the same time, we're going to get better yields and it's going to be better in this. So it's not exactly the same. It can't be. And it's the same thing with cultured meat.
I think it's awesome that he wrote the book, and I think everybody should go out and buy it. I read it, and I'm having a really horrible reaction to it, and I think everyone should read it and have their own personal reaction. Some people will probably dig it. It's just pushing me farther into the world of being a vegan.
Well, it's fascinating to read how the food industry works and how angel investors and powerful investors have so much control.
Yeah. Well, good for them.
Yeah. Now, I can understand maybe there are some scientists that are really intrigued by this, trying to be able to make meat.
You know, the only thing I think it would really be cool about is if somebody has a really horrible disease and they need to have some flesh put back on their body, and, you know, we could get all Star Trek-y, you know, mend someone that's had a horrible accident that needs new muscle or needs to have something rebuilt in their body. I think that's cool. I think, and if we can learn something about how to regenerate muscle tissue in humans to help them fix them, you know, I'm for that.
Well, that's the best thing that could come out of this, actually. Thanks for bringing that up.
So if there's a positive in this,
the investment dollars probably will support the research in order to make meat, and maybe not so much to make
But
things that might help humans in medical environments.
That should tell you, though, what meat really is. Folks, you're eating the muscle of an animal, okay? You're eating the flesh of an animal. Some of the fat that's around the muscle, you're eating that. So if you like eating animal muscle, and you like it grilled, and you like it ground, and you like it put in a burger, terrific. Go for it. Keep eating it. Keep supporting this industry that's just killing a lot of people and making a lot of pharmaceutical producers very wealthy. I'm sorry. You probably didn't want me on your show today.
Yes, of course.
It's kind of dark. But anyway, I'm only filling 10 minutes.
Well, it is kind of dark because we're sitting in the dark.
Well, I mean, it's 99 degrees outside right now.
We've got all the lights off. We've got the shades drawn. We're trying to stay as cool as
we can. And that lovely little low hum that you're hearing is our little tiny R2-D2 air conditioning unit that sits there and works very hard for us. But Karen, another great interview. Chase Purdy, another great book. Thanks for writing it. Thanks, PRN. Thanks, Gary Null. Thanks, Karen Hartglass.
Hey, you know, I want to thank Zoom.
Thanks, Zoom.
Zoom, what an amazing platform.
Yeah.
And it enables us to communicate during a pandemic. And normally I would be in the PRN studio.
Right. And, which we miss. We miss going
to PRN. We do, but the guys are there. They're working.
Way to go, guys. Nice work. Sorry about the loud voice. I know you'll have to fix it in post.
So anyway, we just have a couple minutes wrapping up our talk back here. And I just want to talk about delicious food.
Yeah, we've been making a lot of delicious food, despite the fact that it's difficult to cook in this heat. But we still managed to cook. Yesterday, you just knocked out a smorgasbord of food. It was like walking into one of the bodegas in Manhattan with the big steam tables and just like loading my plate up. I was like, where's all this food coming from?
Right. And we've got leftovers and I can't wait to load up again. But what I wanted to say, we talked last week or a couple of weeks, I don't know, it's all a blur, but we were talking about summer foods, and pesto is a great food to make, especially if you can grow basil in your garden, right?
Yeah.
And we have great recipes. Gary's come up with all of them. And so yesterday, I picked some fresh basil from our little terrace garden.
Yes, our pathetic little terrace garden.
And there wasn't enough to really make a big jar of pesto. I took the
Vitamix.
I took the Vitamix, but the recipe we have for pesto on the website, I'll link it. And I made a quarter of the recipe because I just didn't have enough to make the normal recipe.
But got very clever.
In the Vitamix, with that little bunch of ingredients, it wouldn't blend. There just wasn't enough. So I had to add water. and I added enough water so that I got a nice creamy basil-y sauce.
Yes.
And it was thin. And I poured that over my summer vegetables that were
sauteing
in a pan. I had red peppers, or they were orange peppers, and zucchini. And I had cooked some Japanese sweet potatoes. I cubed everything and then put them all in a pan. I added some cubed tofu. And then when I was all ready, I poured this sauce over it, and it thickened naturally because it reduced.
Yeah, you reduced it down.
It was
you
fantastic.
Were just working away in here. I couldn't believe it. It
yes.
was, well, I could believe it because you work nonstop.
Well, what happened was
you are
I was
worker,
all, I
the
was,
worker here.
I was stressed out because we had a little plumbing problem under the sink.
Yeah.
Which I think has resolved itself, but I was online for too long looking for parts. And
yeah, everybody who's listening out there, Karen is also a plumber.
Yeah, anyway, so I was all frustrated, and when I was all done and I made my decision and I made my order online, I decided I would go in the kitchen, because for me, that's how I relax, chopping and cooking. That's how I relax.
Yeah, I'm here to confirm that. You, in all kinds of weather, love to just unwind in the kitchen. And what comes out is brilliant. The meal yesterday was fabulous.
Yep.
And today we don't have to heat it up. We can just eat it cold.
Yeah, it'll be great.
Yeah, I like that. Well, the only thing we're missing is hot sauce, but that's okay. We can make some of that.
You want hot sauce in this heat?
I'm kidding.
You know, some people think eating hot food in hot weather helps.
I don't believe that.
I don't either.
Not for one second. But it's true. There's a lot of people that say, no, dear, have a nice cup of tea in this 90-degree weather. Like a hot cup of tea. I tried it yesterday. I had some Ticino hot. And it just made me hotter.
Yeah, you got to have it cold. Thank whoever invented the ice cube. Anyway, Gary, I want to say I'm looking forward to my shows in the next couple of weeks, because I'll be talking with Seth Tibbett, who wrote In Search of the Wild Tofurkey. I read the book. I really loved it.
What a great book.
I also have an interview with Joel D. and his wife, Allison, and he founded Edward & Sons, which is a wonderful company, and he's going to be sharing some great stories about that. And talking to both of them, I love their businesses. I love what they've done. They've created these vegetarian, vegan businesses with heart.
Right.
And, you know, after reading about Billion Dollar Burger, some of those companies that are making plant-based meats have some heart in them. They have a vegan mission in them.
And they don't affect your heart in the
right.
same way.
No, they don't.
That
these other businesses
these other
do.
Businesses
yeah,
do.
So
these are
I'm
hard, healthy
forward.
Businesses. Like
I'm looking forward to that.
Tofurkey is... What's not to love about tofurkey? I mean, if you got to transition off the animal and you want something that reminds you of a chewy, salty, fleshy piece of meat that you can put between two pieces of bread, I say go with tofurkey.
Tofurkey, they're really...
Go with tofurkey. That got me off the animal.
The ingredients are pretty good in tofurkey for a processed...
Yeah, they're not
food.
Highly processed, right?
Yep.
Yeah, some of these other meats are, but I would say tofurkey is the go-to.
There you go.
Yeah.
Gary, thanks for joining me. We're out of time. Always fun to wrap up with you.
It was really great. And speaking of heart, Karen, you have nothing but heart.
Well, I'm heart glass.
That's what I'm saying.
Whatever that means.
You gotta have heart, miles and miles and miles of heart.
That's it, everybody. That's our show. Remember,
have a delicious week.